Okay, please make kasha. May the sacred presence of the one who said he would abide in his teachings be our guide. May we follow his glorious example and walk with unfaltering step this noble path until we too shall attain enlightenment.
All the Buddhas for our space and time, all honored ones, bodhisattvas, mahasattvas, wisdom beyond wisdom, maha, prajna, paramita.
Good evening, everybody. So this is the first class of the newly expanded foundational teaching series. Going from 5 or 6 classes in the past to 11 classes this year. And I think we'll fill up the time quite adequately. We're not adding any new teachings, but I think we're going to be spending a fair amount more time diving into them. And okay, well, first I'll introduce myself and my assistant, who's not here for the first two classes, so I can say whatever I want. I'm Gyoshi Kaplan. Just a real brief Zen CV. I started tiptoeing around Zen in probably about 1965 with college classes and books and so on. And then really dug into it in the late 60s when I moved to California for medical school. And I was going to the Los Altos Zen group meetings while I was there. And Suzuki Roshi was leading those meetings. He was coming down, and this is what the talks he gave us then were what became enshrined in the book Zen Mind, Beginner's Mind. So that was, yeah.
Pretty cool.
Pretty cool beginning. but it didn't really take. He gave me my first koan. I rejected it. he's me still dealing with it. And eventually, though, what really stuck was I had moved up to British Columbia, and one of the people who was living on the same commune where I was living left and ended up at Shasta Abbey and became a priest there. And he wrote me and said, "Hey, Mike, you need to come on down here and check this out." So I did, and ended up spending 2 lay terms there in 2 consecutive years, 74 and 75, which is about when Gyopiko showed up there also. I received the precepts from Roshi Kennett in 1974 at Shasta Abbey. And I have been a member of Dharma Rain since, I think, 1983. Became Kyogen's disciple in the year 2000 and received lay transmission from him in 2014. I've been, it's what I've been doing since then. I've been leading the Oregon State Penitentiary Sangha, the Zen meditation group we hold there at the penitentiary. I've been doing that for about 10 years and participating actively here. Julie Burtis, who had previously committed to a vacation, has been a member of Dharma Rain since 1996, and she became a lay disciple of Gyokoko's in 2001. She completed 7 years of residential Zen training, 2 of which were here, and 5 at San Francisco Zen Center. I was going to pass around the sign-up sheet, but I didn't bring anything to write with or anything. Do we need a sign-up sheet?
We don't absolutely need it.
Yeah. Do you want it for administrative purposes at all?
You know, if people will sign the guest book, which is out here on the, if you haven't been here before, sign the guest book, give us your email address. What we'll do is we'll put you on our email list, and you can get right back out of it if you want. It's a very secure unsubscribe if you don't want it. But it gives you, what that does is it gives you a weekly email that says, here's what we're doing this Sunday, here's some coming events, here's some things that are going on in Dharma Rain. So, yes.
I've never received an email.
Well,
sign up again.
You can sign up on the website. There's a tab down at the bottom on the right side that says get our subscriber newsletter or something like that. If you click that, you should be able to sign up.
Yeah, that works a lot better.
Rachel, I'm going to read it right now.
Okay. So I'd like to learn who you all are. We won't do names because I'll remember maybe one of them. But just show of hands, how many of you are fairly new or brand new to Buddhism? 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, maybe 7, okay? New to meditation practice of any variety?
Yeah. What are we calling new?
Do
in comparison to you, for sure.
You have no idea what to do when you go in there and sit on the cushion. Okay, so how many new to meditation practice of any sort? Okay, so everybody's had some experience with meditation. Okay, excellent. New to Dharma Rain? First time, second time here? 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7. Okay. How many of you have taken the Buddhist precepts?
Oh, yeah.
Probably a little over half of us. How many have taken this class before, this class series, the foundational teachings? Can we be about the same here? Okay. And how many are here taking this class series as a prerequisite for seminary? Okay, just a couple.
Can we do names? I'm good at remembering.
Okay, and you'll cue me. Okay, sure. Let's go around with names. I'm Yoshi.
Genko.
Yoan.
Mike.
Katie.
Kian.
Daijo.
Carl.
Hakuyu.
Rachel.
Will.
Tom.
Bert.
Rachel.
Shinyu.
Sophie.
Isaac.
Marisela.
Koken.
Rhea.
Lilith.
Matt.
Kristen.
Erin.
Janice. Christina.
Charlie.
Katie.
Kyle.
Chris.
Okay, thank you. Now I'm going to ask for a volunteer. There's a whiteboard up there. It's right here. You can be a volunteer then. And I would just like, popcorn. Usually, so the names we went clockwise. We do almost everything here clockwise. And actually, in Buddhism in general, everything is done clockwise. What is your hope for yourself in this class series? What do you hope to get out of this class? You think that
looking
forward
to? That's a pretty popcorn style. Just throw it out.
Anybody?
I like Wednesdays because it helps me to think less and feel more.
Okay. Thank you.
Because the Wednesdays help what?
I think less and feel more.
Uh-huh.
Forces me.
Anybody else?
I'm interested in what's going to be different or new or expanded in the expanded class.
Okay, I'll get to that in a little bit. Anyone else?
This is something that Genko and I teach a really truncated version of, and I would like to see somebody else's presentation material. Mm-hmm. What sort of things you find important and bring up.
Okay. But you mentioned that I'm in the midst of teaching the same series in the prison, and they helped me prepare for this. Anybody else? Okay.
Sense of community.
Sense of community.
Kind of went right along with Keon's, really. pretty similar.
Okay, I want to start again with an invocation that speaks to the attitude that I would encourage you to bring to this class series. And this comes, I'm paraphrasing Thich Nhat Hanh in one of the recommended books. Let's see. Yeah, this one here, The Heart of the Buddhist Teaching. By the way, I brought all the books that are on the syllabus, which we'll pass around here in just a little bit. That is the syllabus, not the books. But I think what I'll do is after, when we're done with the class, but before Vespers, I'll put them over on the table, and anybody who wants can look at them and decide whether you want to order them now or not. It won't be ordered from Dharma Ray, with the exception of Kyogen's booklet.
They might also be in our library.
Yeah, they might well. Yeah, there might be a few copies there. So, borrowing from Thich Nhat Hanh, when we hear a Dharma teaching, our only job is to remain open. Usually when we hear or read something new, we just compare it to our own ideas. If it's the same, we accept it and say that it's correct. If it's not, we say it's incorrect. In either case, we learn nothing. If we read or listen with an open mind and an open heart, the rain of the Dharma will penetrate the soil of our consciousness. So my hope, and this reflects your comment. My hope is that you'll approach the class series with that attitude. You're never asked in Buddhism to believe anything, but what I do ask of you is to take it in, weigh it against your own experience, live it, and a lot of these things will not germinate. They're seeds, but they will not really germinate for possibly years. But if you take it in wholeheartedly, it's there to grow in you. The class is going to be highly participatory and experiential. A little bit less so tonight, just because tonight's more of a explanatory class around the Buddha's life. But a little bit tonight and in future classes, I'm going to try to mix in various different experiential methods of getting at some of these teachings. And that's a large part of why this is expanding out, so that we can get more into the experiential practices. As an adjunct to this course, I'm really pleased to see that all of you have some experience with meditation. And I strongly urge you to, as part of this, to make best use of this class and to make best use of your lives, try to go for a daily meditation practice. And I would say it's impossible to really penetrate any of these teachings without a meditation practice. It's easy to get an intellectual understanding or comprehension of the teachings, but to actually get them takes sitting in stillness. The frequency of meditation, I think, is more important, especially if you're fairly new to it. It's more important than the length of time that you spend in it. So for those of you who are new, for those of us who are very old, or for those of us who are adverse to doing meditation, I encourage you to just make the personal vow to sit every day, if even for only 5 minutes. If you want some instruction with meditation, we have Zen meditation workshops. Unfortunately, the most recent one was last night, I think, yes? But the next one is going to be Thursday the 27th in the evening, 7 p.m. And again, you can check the Dharma Rain website for the full calendar of things. And then I also recommend that you find time after each class to reflect on the teachings that you heard during that class. Reflect on how it plays out in your life. And we'll be giving you some suggestions for particular lenses to look through there. So, why the foundational teachings classes? You gave us some ideas. Okay, so here's a personal story. Many, many years ago, before Dharma Rain existed, when we were still Oregon Zen Priory, and we were meeting at a house in Northeast Portland, I think there might have been a dozen of us regularly at that. Kyogen was giving a Dharma talk. This is when Kyogen was freshly arrived up here from Shasta Abbey. He was giving a Dharma talk, and I was kind of dozing off a little bit. And all of a sudden, I woke up to these words, and that's the only thing you really need to know in this practice. So, this class series, there's going to be a lot of those. This is the only thing you really need to know in your practice. Or maybe there's just one for each one of you. Okay? I never did get to ask him what that was. I was embarrassed. I mean, you know, 30 years of embarrassment on that.
Your second koan.
Yes. The first one, by the by, may resonate with some of you, was I went up to Suzuki Roshi after one of these sitting group meetings, and I was on the verge of dropping out of medical school and feeling a strong spiritual path pull. And I went up, expecting him to just really greet me and embrace me with, and say, "Oh, this is so good. I'm so glad you are following this path." When I told him that I was dropping out of med school, and instead he just looked at me and said, "Well, actually, you can do everything you need to do right where you are." I dropped out anyway. But that koan's been with me, and it's a good koan. We can do everything we need to do right where we are. These teachings form a basis for making the most of a lot, or probably all the other classes of Dharma Rain. The teachings are challenging and often mysterious. Does everybody know what I mean when I say koan? Does anybody, probably, I'll just say real brief. Koan is a Zen term, and it's kind of a riddle. It's a question that's asked or a statement that's made to a student that defies rational thought. You don't solve it with rational thought or conceptual thought. So examples are, what was your original face before your parents were born? There's a whole slew of these koans. But we also talk in Soto Zen about the koan appearing naturally in daily life. So I think more often I make use of it in that sense, that daily life gives us our koans. Okay, so my hope is that you will connect personally with these teachings and make them your own. You will probably make sense of them in different ways than I pour out. And that's fine. That's part of making it your own. So let's pass out the syllabus. This is more than the maximum number I was told to expect, so we may not have enough for everybody.
And it's also on the website.
And it's on the website, yes. If you go to this schedule, why don't you describe the way in?
Well, there's a couple of ways to it, but it's really on the classes page. And so if you go to Getting Involved, and under that there's a menu item that says Classes, and you go to that page, you'll get pretty soon to this foundational teachings, and you can click on it to the syllabus. And I think on the online calendar, I've also connected to that classes page, so looks like we have
enough. Do we have enough? Mm-hmm. Oh, excellent.
Not everyone is taking it.
Okay. So let me go through a few things here. First of all, you see the schedule, but I think you all must know the schedule because you're here. The instructors, as I say, are myself and Julie Burtis, and there are emails, addresses there. So if you have questions, comments, suggestions, whatever, I welcome you to email me. Okay? Also, questions can be asked at any time during class. I and all of the transmitted teachers are also available. I guess you're the only other transmitted teacher tonight. Are also available for sanzen, either formal sanzen or informal sanzen. And again, if you email me, if you want to talk with me in sanzen, I have to explain what sanzen is to me. Sanzen is basically a Dharma conversation, personal meeting between the teacher and the person who's coming in for sanzen. And it can take a number of different forms. It can be some specific question you have, usually just one or two questions. Otherwise, they can get very lengthy, which is what they do in prison. Or it can be some expression. You want to just express something that's going on with you related to your practice. So those are examples. Anyway, that is available to you. You can email me. You can email staff. And you can also go to the website and see who the teachers are. Let's see. Then we talk about why study foundational teachings, and we've already talked about that. And then we have the listing of the classes. You can read that yourself. I don't need to read that to you. But I do want to point out that there's two holes in the schedule. So we have a class next week, but then the week after that there is no class because we have a session going on here then, the hard work session. And then again, the Wednesday before Thanksgiving, there's no class. Other than that, we'll be meeting every week through November 28th. Textbooks. There are no real texts for this, but there are a number of sources. Two of the sources we're recommending are Kyogen's book of Zen Roots, and he addresses most of the stuff, not all the stuff, but most of the stuff we're talking about in these classes.
And for people who are new, Kyogen is one of our founders.
These are available. Genko can fit you up with them. They were charging, what, $5?
Yeah, $1.
If you can do it. If you can't do it, talk to Genko. This book that I mentioned, Thich Nhat Hanh. I should say Thich Nhat Hanh has sometimes a novel approach to some of the teachings. But I find that actually really useful to get a different slant on some of the traditional ways we talk about this. Some of the other ones, The Buddha and His Teachings, by Burkholz and Chosen Kohn. This one is kind of interesting. Again, you can look at this after the class. It has a nice introduction about the life of the Buddha, and I'll be reading a little bit out of that tonight. It also has a number of essays by different teachers on different subjects of the basic teachings. So this will be up there for you to look at. I can't really tell you much about this, but it's been on the curriculum for years. I admit, the language is a little bit stilted. It's a fairly old book.
That's kind of a Theravadan approach to it.
It's a Theravadan.
It's got some good stuff.
This is nice if you want to get into some of the historical details. It has stuff on the basic teachings, and it also gets into the history and gives a lot of information about the different branches of Buddhism. And then this one. This is actually not just about Buddhism. This is Hewson Smith's The Illustrated World of Religions. And he was a professor of comparative religion, but he was unusual in that he practiced four of the major religions that he speaks of in this book for at least 10 years each. Buddhism, Hinduism, Islam, and Christianity. He studied Zen for, I think, 10 years. And he's a very clear writer, so I'm turning to him for some of the stuff we're doing tonight. It's also a very pretty book. Okay. Any questions about the syllabus, about the logistics of the class?
Wednesday nights, is this going to be like a half period of Zazen?
Yes.
Every Wednesday for...
One period, yeah.
Or have one period.
Yeah. And you don't have to come to that if you don't want, but I do encourage it. After the class, we have something called Vespers, which is almost the only remnant of the Gregorian chanting that we used to do at Shasta Abbey. And it's a very beautiful service. It's a nice way to end the day, practice day. I should also mention that if anybody needs to leave early, because they have to get up early, whatever, that's perfectly fine. Just get up and leave. Okay, let's... Oh, so Julie brought this to me as a... as a castanet that explains the Buddha's life. and it's also,
heavy.
You can work out with it too as we pass this around. So this is something that she picked up in India a number of years ago. And this, on the outside here, it shows his mother, it's just having given birth. This is the baby Buddha who one of the myths says, popped out and got up, walked seven steps, and proclaimed that he was there to enlighten everybody. On the other side is the other end of his life, his what we call his parinirvana, when he was lying on his deathbed. So I'll pass this around, and you all can get a workout then. On the inside, we show two manifestations of the Buddha. One is the, it's all skin and bones. So that's a reflection of him during his ascetic years, which we'll get to here in a few minutes. And then we have Buddha basically on the seat of enlightenment. How many of you are at least somewhat familiar, or is anybody not at all familiar? That's probably easier. Does anybody know nothing about the Buddhist story? Sorry. Okay. Good. That gives me an excuse, and you know very little. Good. I'm glad.
I know about Buddha. I know some of his teachings, but I don't know his actual story.
Yeah. No. That's great. Otherwise, I wouldn't have anything to teach tonight. So why do we want to talk about the Buddha's life? It's fun. But beyond that, if we notice how the story is affecting us, it can inform us, about who we are. And also what we most deeply need. So that's what his life story is about. The path of the Buddha. We have something called the precepts. Here at Dharma Rain, the ceremony, and this is the same way it was done at Shasta Abbey, the ceremony goes... there's a whole study course leading up to it of studying the precepts, the 16 precepts, 10 grave precepts of such things: do not kill, do not steal, do not misuse sexuality, and so forth. And then there's a couple other levels of precepts. And when it comes time for the Jikai ceremony of actually taking the precepts, the questions asked of the people who are taking the precepts, is it your wish to become a Buddhist? Working in the prison, I didn't feel like that fit the prison situation very well. It was they had no context to understand that in. And also, it probably wasn't anybody's wish to become a Buddhist, but they were interested in doing the Buddhist practice. So we changed the wording there to, is it your wish to follow the path of the Buddha? And the guys there seem to resonate with it. By the way, I say the guys because Oregon State Penitentiary, for those of you who don't know, is it's the only maximum security prison in Oregon, and it's an all-male prison, or at least all-male for the inmates. So, when they vow to follow the Buddha's way, it's important that they know what that Buddha's way is. And that's what this is all about here. There's a lot of scholarly uncertainty and disagreement about the actual facts of his life, the Buddha's life, and what he actually taught even. We have nothing that was written down until almost 100 years after his death, with most written descriptions starting several hundred years after that. Yet the oral transmission is considered quite accurate. He had one disciple called Ananda who I guess had a or an audio memory? Is that what you call it?
I don't know, audiographic
memory? Audiographic memory. Anyway, he was able to remember things word for word. By the way, if there's time left over, we'll please yell on all the names at the end. But the Buddha, one of his main teachings was not to blindly accept his teachings. You know, he was throwing out, we talked about finger pointing to the moon, and Kyogen used to say that all of this is just a finger pointing towards the teachings. You know, words are not the teachings. And the Buddha taught what I was telling you in the beginning here, that you're not asked to believe anything. You're just asked to hear it, weigh it, and see if it's true in your life. So we consider his life and teachings and don't grasp after knowledge or facts. Instead, we just invite a whole body of understanding, the understanding in body, heart, and mind. You all have a sense of what I'm talking about there? Is anybody mystified? Okay. So, you know, some examples of the mythology in the Buddha's life stories, or at least seems to me it's mythology. The Pali Jataka commentary recounts no fewer than 547 past lives of the Buddha. And then there's all kinds of delightful stories about what they were. In whatever form the Buddha appeared in these stories, I mean, he might appear as a king or as a lion or an elephant or a god, in whatever form he exhibits some virtue that plays out in his teachings. So Siddhartha Gautama was born sometime between 625 and 480 BCE, before the Common Era. Modern archaeology and other studies seems to point more towards the 480 date. But some of these readings that you see are going to talk more about, I think, like 560, something like that. Whenever it was exactly, you know, I can't speak to the scholarly studies. Whenever it was, he taught for the last 45 years of his life, and he lived 80 years. Some context for early Buddhism. By about 1500 BC, nomadic herders had long since, you know, maybe 1,000 years before that, had migrated down from the Central Asian steppes and arrived in northern India. And The race was called Aryans. Largely, they were warriors, and they quickly dominated Northwest India. They incorporated the existing culture and supposedly reinvigorated it. In Snelling's book here, again, this is where I'm getting some of the history sources, it says the Vedic age was roughly 1500 to 500 BC, and of course, Buddha was born into it right around then. At the center of religious life during the Vedic age lay the ritual of sacrifice. This was, however, completely controlled by the hereditary Brahmin priesthood, who claimed that they alone were fitted by birth to perform sacrifice. I'm going to pass out a couple of other things here while I'm talking. Yeah, let's get this passed. Yes. So the Brahmin priesthood kind of grew into claiming that they alone were fitted by birth to perform sacrifice, which was one of the main rituals. And they jealously guarded the secrets of priestly function. We don't do that here. A rigid caste system developed during this time, and the caste system was a closed system. Upward, downward mobility just didn't happen. And in many ways, many believe that even if there was reincarnation, you're reincarnated into the same caste. Going on from Snelling, he said that the spiritual health and richness of India, though, owe rather less to Brahmanism than to an alternative tradition that had its roots in pre-Aryan culture. And this was essentially an ascetic tradition, and exponents were not Brahmanas as a rule, but rather Kshatriyas of the warrior or aristocratic caste, which we'll find out is what Buddha was born into. They would renounce the world and go off either singly or in small groups into the solitude of forest and mountain retreat. The best of them withdrew from their social duties for only the highest spiritual purposes. They no doubt practiced meditation and other mystical disciplines. Such practices may date back to pre-Vedic times. So Buddha's life journey appears to have fit well into that home-leaving spiritual investigation paradigm of the time. Okay, so let me just get to where you are here. The first handout I did, the one that has the Buddha statue on the front. The grumpy one, yeah, the serious one. Okay, I'm not going to go too far into this. The point of this reading, and I'll leave it up to you to actually do the reading if it's of interest to you. The point of this reading is to point out how the Buddha was born into a tradition and found the tradition unsatisfactory for meeting the spiritual needs that he was feeling. And went off on a traditional path from that point, and the traditional path didn't meet his needs. And eventually he went off, he found his own path. We'll get into that with the story here in a few minutes. Smith postulates that there are six normal features of religions: authority, you know, as we saw in the Brahmin caste, ritual, which was turning into basically sacrifice in India at that time, explanations or theology, dogma, tradition, you follow what's been said or done before as directed by the religious authorities, grace, or the belief and assurance that reality is on our side, and can be counted on. We don't actually have to do anything. And in fact, we can't do anything. That was what he was born into, that concept. And then mystery, that being finite, the human mind can't fathom the infinite that envelops it. And then quoting further from this article here, he says, each of these six things contributes to religion while being able to clog its works. In the Hinduism of Buddha's day, they had done that. Authority had become hereditary and exploitative as Brahmins took to hoarding their religious secrets and charging exorbitantly for ministrations. Rituals have become mechanical means for working miracles. Explanations have lost their experiential base and developed into arguments. God's grace was being misread in ways that undercut human responsibility, and mystery was confused with mystification, obsession with miracles, the occult, and the fantastic. And the Buddha blew most of that up. So I'll leave it to you if you want to read more about that in here. It explains how he blew that up. It also acknowledges that some of that concretizing has cropped up again in traditions and then gets cleaned out, crops up again, and so on. Any questions on that? Yeah, do interrupt me if you have questions or want to follow something here. Okay, so now we're going to get into this other reading here that I passed out, the one without a Buddha on the cover, The Man Who Woke Up. And what I want to do, we're going to read this in small chunks. And I forgot the time here, but what we'll do then is, how's this going to work? We'll see if this works. If it doesn't work, we'll have to do a whole group of conversations. What I would like to do is break up into small groups after we read each chunk of his life, one phase of his life, and I'll prompt you with some questions. I'm borrowing from what you and Shintai did a number of years ago. Mm-hmm. So let's see how this works. So in the group, you are going to just share around the questions that I raise or anything else that resonates with you on that phase of his life. Try to keep your voices down because I can imagine this just going nuts in this room.
There are some other spaces that we can come into.
Yeah, but then we're going to, by the time we reorganize, we'll run out of time. We'll try it once, and if it's a disaster, we will just do a whole group sharing after that, okay? So, the first chunk are the circumstances around his birth. And by the way, a lot of this is also in Kielgen's book, in Zen Roots. He has a rather nice exposition of it. So you might want to look at that too. So Shakyamuni Buddha, this is the Burkholz book, The Buddha and His Teachings. This, if you want to get more into some of the mystical side of the, or some of the legend, this is a nice source for that. So Shakyamuni Buddha, the awakened one, recounted his own story to his close disciple Ananda. And the first part of this is all of his previous births. I'm okay with that at this point. It was in the middle of the first millennium BCE that the Bodhisattva took his final birth in the country of the Shakyas, which lay in the foothills of the Himalayas in present-day southern Nepal. His father, Suddhodana, was the king of the Shakyas, and as befitted a king, he was of the Kshatriya or warrior caste, and his clan lineage, that of the Gautamas, was ancient and pure. The Bodhisattva's mother was Mahamaya, the daughter of Superbuddha, a powerful Shakya noble. Since the Bodhisattva was born a prince of the Shakyas, after his enlightenment, he was known as the sage of the Shakyas, Shakyamuni. Since his clan name was Gautama, he was later also called Gautama Buddha. So one night during the Midsummer Festival in Kapilavastu, Queen Mahamaya dreamed that she ascended a height and a large and beautiful white elephant with six tusks entered her womb through her right side. And then a great multitude bowed down to her. When she awoke, she had a feeling of great well-being and knew she was with child. When she told the king of this, he called his Brahmin wise men who were versed in astrology and the interpretation of dreams. The Brahmins told the king that a son would be born to him who would have the 32 major marks and the 80 minor marks of a great being. If he remained in the palace in pursuit of worldly life, he would become a universal monarch. However, if he renounced his home, wealth, and position, and wandered forth as a holy man, he would become a completely enlightened Buddha and satisfy all beings with the elixir of deathlessness. The king, at that moment, I'd add, was very pleased with these predictions, and he gave the Brahmins rich gifts and distributed food and gifts to the people. So, should we try the small groups first?
Sure.
Okay, let's try. I mean, you know, what I like about small groups is it gives everybody a chance to talk, and it also avoids the hurdle of talking to such a large group of people. So, that first chunk are the circumstances of his birth. The prophecies about being a great ruler, a great spiritual leader. So, what I would ask you to discuss are, what were the circumstances of your birth? The spiritual circumstances, what were you born into? Were you born into some expectations? Okay? So go with that, just, you know, make small groups of three and try to keep your voices low, and I will find a bell for the Matthew over there that will signal the end of this. Take about 4 or 5 minutes, okay?
Cool.
That work for everybody?
Sure.
Yeah.
Okay, cool.
Yeah.
Cool.
Good. Didn't seem too
loud. Yeah, we'll go with it then. Okay, so now let's move into phase two, his youth through his mid-20s. Let's see here. If we were in prison, I would, you know, we would be passing the reading around and each person would read a paragraph or two. We can do that if you like. If anybody would like to, okay, well, let's try that. It's nice to get somebody else talking besides me. So, in this, the man who woke up, you look on the first page down about 4 paragraphs. It starts with "Here in short was a man." Anybody want to read that? And I'll stop you when we get to the end of that phase.
Here in short was a man who seemed to have everything, social standing, appearance, wealth, a model wife, a child, and a throne he would soon inherit. Despite all of this, however, there settled over him in his 20s a despond that was to lead him to abandon his lucky lot. The cause of his discontent is impounded in the legend of the 4 passing sights. When Siddhartha was born, his father summoned fortune tellers to discern his future. All agreed that this was no usual child, but his career was crossed with an ambiguity. If he succeeded his father, he would unify India and become a world conqueror. But if he forsook the world, he would become a world redeemer. His father wanted the former destiny, so he spared no effort to keep his son on course. Palaces and dancing girls were placed at his disposal, and orders were given that no unpleasantness be allowed into his court of life. When he left the palace, runners were stationed to clear the roads of the old, the diseased, and the dead. One day, however, this order was neglected, and Siddhartha saw an old man, gaunt, broken-toothed, trembling as he leaned on his staff. Another day, he saw a body racked with disease, lying by the roadside. On the third outing, he encountered a corpse. Having thus discovered the facts of aging, disease, and death, he saw on a fourth ride a monk with shaven head, orchard robe, and bowl, and learned from him of a path that renounces the world. It is a legend, the story, but it impounds the truth that it was the body's inescapable involvement with disease, decrepitude, and death that made his despair of finding fulfillment on a physical plane.
Let's stop there. So let's go back to our small groups. And we're going to run out of time, so we'll just keep this short, and then I think we'll probably have to just go through the reading here. So go to the small groups, and my questions I suggest are, did your parents protect you from experience? Did you have that sense of being protected from life?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Mm-hmm. And can you see any spiritual trajectory to your experience during those years that have any resonance with the Buddhists? Okay.
All right.
Okay. Would somebody like to read the next paragraph, starting with 1 CSRC? Is on the right-hand page of the...
Sure. Once he had perceived the inevitability of pain and passage, fleshly pleasures lost their charm, and he determined to follow the calling of a truth-seeker. One night in his 29th year, he effected his great going forth. Taking silent farewell of his sleeping wife and child, he mounted his great white steed and set off for a forest. Reaching its edge, he discarded his royal attire, shaved his head, and entered the forest to seek enlightenment.
Okay, stop there. I have to add one fact here that I think is relevant, and that is that he had a son born, or his wife Yasodhara bore a son just a few days before this painting that's described here. And so he was leaving not only, you know, the possibility of becoming a great ruler, he was leaving the role of husband, he was leaving the role of father, he was leaving everything behind. And remember what I read to you about this tradition, this ascetic tradition, that kind of played into this. So this was almost expected of this particular clan, the Shakyas. So far, he's following one path anyway. So, a few questions on this. Have you experienced some form of spiritually-based home leaving in your life? Leaving things behind. With kind of spiritual aspiration behind that. And did he have some sense of resolve or intent in his home leaving?
That's it.
Did he have some sense of resolve or intent in doing that? We have 10 minutes left. I think these small groups are working, though.
Yeah.
Yeah? So let's keep going. If you don't get through this life, so be it. So the next phase of his life, I would call the kind of radical experimentation. And I think I'm going to skip this. This is the part where he hangs out with five other ascetics and basically wears himself out. And there's an important teaching that comes from this, which is his discovery that basically he was close to death. And that's, you saw the emaciated Buddha in there. And there's a lot of descriptions that go with that. Pretty stark. He came to the realization that it wasn't getting him anywhere. Or at least it got him only so far and no further. And there's a story of a milkmaid named Sujata. This was in Bodh Gaya, India. And she brought him some milk. She saw him sitting under a tree, and she brought him some rice milk. And he ate a little bit of it and felt rejuvenated, and that's what gave him the energy to go to the next step. So, again, I think one of the themes of this stage is experimentation, trying out different spiritual paths, and being ready to move on when it's not working. the next stage, which I call the sit till you get it stage, starts on the second page here.
That was probably preceding Kyogen's comment.
Sorry?
That was probably what you missed when you were sleeping through Kyogen's terms. Yeah,
right.
That's all you need to know.
There you go. That's one of them. We should actually collect on the whiteboard. This is all you need to know. So would anybody like to start reading at having renounced mortification?
I'll read it.
Okay.
Having renounced mortification, Gautama devoted the final phase of his quest to a combination of rigorous thought and mystic concentration along the lines of Hinduism's Raja Yoga. Sensing at length that a breakthrough was near, he sat down one evening under what has come to be known as the Bo Tree, short for Bodhi or Enlightenment, vowing not to arise until he had gained his goal. The records offer, as the first events of the night, a temptation scene reminiscent of Jesus in the desert. Seeking to disrupt Gautama's concentration, Mara, the evil one, first paraded voluptuous women, and when they failed in their purpose, assailed the future Buddha with torrents of flaming rocks. These, though, turned into blossom petals when they entered the field of his yogic concentration. In final desperation, Mara challenged Gautama's right to do what he was doing, but he touched the earth with his right fingertip, and the earth thundered. I bear you witness. Mara fled in rout and raptures, descended from heaven to clothe the victor. Thereafter, while the Bo tree rained red blossoms that full mooned night of May, Gautama's meditation deepened until, as the morning star glittered in the transparent eastern sky, his mind pierced the world's bubble, collapsing it to nothing. Only, wonder of wonders, to find it restored with the effulgence of true being. The great awakening had arrived. Gautama was gone. He had been replaced by the Buddha.
Okay, stop there. And many renditions have him proclaiming on his awakening there that something to the effect, I am awakened together with all sentient beings. Mm. And that's another koan. What could that possibly mean? We don't really have time for discussion on this. I would throw out for your reflection over the next week some questions. What's your experience with Tao? Have you tried and been able to support your spiritual journey with clear intention or Tao? And for that matter, have you felt spiritual yearning or aspiration? Can you identify that? The longing of your heart. And then this gets a distraction. Mara is brought up here as an evil one, but Mara is basically the workings of our mind, which has endless entertainments and distractions. So what distracts you and what do you do about it? So I think we'll stop the reading there. I encourage you to read the rest of this story, and if you end up getting this book, there's a lot in here. Kyogen's account, I think, stops short of the enlightenment and the teaching phase of his life. At least I didn't see it in the part of the book I was looking at earlier. And I just wanted to give you a preview of next week. We will be getting into the Four Noble Truths. We're splitting it into two classes, so we'll do the first two Noble Truths next week. There'll be a number of exercises that we do with that, some guided meditations and so on. First Noble Truth is that human existence involves suffering. So one thing you can bring to class next week is your suffering. Connection with your suffering. And then the following class will be the third and fourth Noble Truths, which includes the cessation of suffering and the path for that. Suggested practice until we meet next week is, first of all, do your meditation. see if you can make it a daily practice. If you can't, if you want to and can't, don't bash yourself about it. Just note your vow, note your aspiration, and try again the next day. If certain portions of the Buddhist story particularly resonate with you, reflect on them. As you go through your day, be alert to how some of the themes that we talked about today play out in your life. We're at 9 o'clock. Any last comments or questions? I'll leave the books up here on the table for you to look at.